presume to borrow the superfluous ornaments of the churches. The desertion of the Manichaeans was supplied by some tribes of Moldavia. A reinforcement of 7,000 Turks replaced and revenged the loss of their brethren. And the Greek soldiers were exercised to ride, to draw the bow, and to the daily practice of ambuscades and evolutions. Alexius had been taught by experience that the formidable cavalry of the Franks on foot was unfit for action, and almost incapable of motion. His archers were directed to aim their arrows at the horse rather than the man, and a variety of spikes and snares were scattered over the ground on which he might expect an attack. In the neighborhood of Larissa, the events of war were protracted and balanced. The courage of Bohemond was always conspicuous, and often successful. But his camp was pillaged by a stratagem of the Greeks. The city was impregnable, and the venal or discontented counts deserted his standard, betrayed their trusts, and enlisted in the service of the emperor. Alexius returned to Constantinople with the advantage, rather than the honor, of victory. After evacuating the conquests which he could no longer defend, the son of Giscard embarked for Italy and was embraced by a father who esteemed his merit and sympathized in his misfortune. Of the Latin princes, the allies of Alexius and enemies of Robert, the most prompt and powerful was Henry III, or IV, king of Germany and Italy, and future emperor of the West. The epistle of the Greek monarch to his brother is filled with the warmest professions of friendship and the most lively desire of strengthening their alliance by every public and private tie. He congratulates Henry on his success in a just and pious war, and complains that the prosperity of his own empire is disturbed by the audacious enterprises of the Norman Robert. The lists of his presents expresses the manners of the age. A radiated crown of gold, a cross set with pearls to hang on the breast, a case of relics with the names and titles of the saints, a vase of crystal, a vase of sardonyx, some balm, most probably of Mecca, and 100 pieces of purple. To these he added a more solid present of 144,000 Byzantines of gold, with a further assurance of 216,000, so soon as Henry should have entered in arms the Apulian territories and confirmed, by an oath, the league against the common enemy. The German, who was already in Lombardy at the head of an army and a faction, accepted these liberal offers and marched towards the south. His speed was checked by the sound of the Battle of Durazzo, but the influence of his arms or name in the hasty return of Robert was a full equivalent for the Grecian bribe. Henry was the severe adversary of the Normans, the allies and vassals of Gregory VII, his implacable foe. The long quarrel of the throne and mitre had been recently kindled by the zeal and ambition of that haughty priest. The king and the pope had degraded each other, and each had seated a rival on the temporal or spiritual throne of his antagonist. After the defeat and death of his Swabian rebel, Henry descended into Italy to assume the imperial crown and to drive from the Vatican the tyrant of the church. But the Roman people adhered to the cause of Gregory. Their resolution was fortified by supplies of men and money from Apulia, and the city was thrice ineffectually besieged by the king of Germany. In the fourth year he corrupted, as it is said, with Byzantine gold, the nobles of Rome, whose estates and castles had been ruined by the war. The gates, the bridges, and 50 hostages were delivered into his hands. The antipope, Clement III, was consecrated in the Lateran. The grateful pontiff crowned his protector in the Vatican, and the Emperor Henry fixed his residence in the capital as the lawful successor of Augustus and Charlemagne. The ruins of the Septizonium were still defended by the nephew of Gregory. The Pope himself was invested in the castle of St. Angelo, and his last hope was in the courage and fidelity of his Norman vassal. Their friendship had been interrupted by some reciprocal injuries and complaints, but on this pressing occasion Giscard was urged by the obligation of his oath, by his interest, more potent than oaths, by the love of fame, and his enmity to the two emperors. Unfurling the holy banner, he resolved to fly to the relief of the Prince of the Apostles. The most numerous of his armies, 6,000 horse and 30,000 foot, was instantly assembled, and his march from Salerno to Rome was animated by the public applause and the promise of the divine favour. Henry, invincible in 66 battles, trembled at his approach, recollected some indispensable affairs that required his presence in Lombardy, exhorted the Romans to persevere in their allegiance, and hastily retreated 3 days before the entrance of the Normans. In less than 3 years, the son of Tancred of Hauteville enjoyed the glory of delivering the Pope and of compelling the two emperors of the East and West to fly before his victorious arms. But the triumph of Robert was clouded by the calamities of Rome. By the aid of the friends of Gregory, the walls had been perforated or scaled, but the imperial faction was still powerful and active. On the third day, the people rose in a furious tumult, and a hasty word of the conqueror in his defense or revenge was the signal of fire and pillage. The Saracens of Sicily, the subjects of Roger, and auxiliaries of his brother, embraced this fair occasion of rifling and profaning the holy city of the Christians. Many thousands of the citizens, in the sight and by the allies of their spiritual father, were exposed to violation, captivity, or death. And a spacious quarter of the city, from the Lateran to the Colosseum, was consumed by the flames and devoted to perpetual solitude. From a city where he was now hated and might be no longer feared, Gregory retired to end his days in the palace of Salerno. The artful pontiff might flatter the vanity of Giscard with the hope of a Roman or imperial crown, but this dangerous measure, which would have inflamed the ambition of the Norman, must forever have alienated the most faithful princes of Germany. The deliverer and scourge of Rome might have indulged himself in a season of repose, but in the same year of the flight of the German emperor, the indefatigable Robert resumed the design of his eastern conquests. The zeal or gratitude of Gregory had promised to his valour the kingdoms of Greece and Asia. His troops were assembled in arms, flushed with success and eager for action. Their numbers, in the language of Homer, are compared by Anna to a swarm of bees. Yet the utmost and moderate limits of the powers of Giscard have been already defined. They were contained on this second occasion in 120 vessels, and as the season was far advanced, the harbour of Brundusium was preferred to the open road of Otranto. Alexius, apprehensive of a second attack, had assiduously laboured to restore the naval forces of the empire, and obtained from the Republic of Venice an important succour of 36 transports, 14 galleys, and 9 galleons, or ships of extraordinary strength and magnitude. Their services were liberally paid by the license or monopoly of trade, a profitable gift of many shops and houses in the port of Constantinople, and a tribute to St. Mark, the more acceptable as it was the produce of a tax on their rivals at Amalfi. By the union of the Greeks and Venetians, the Adriatic was covered with a hostile fleet, but their own neglect, or the vigilance of Robert, the change of a wind or the shelter of a mist opened a free passage, and the Norman troops were safely disembarked on the coast of Epirus. With 20 strong and well-appointed galleys, their intrepid duke immediately sought the enemy, and though more accustomed to fight on horseback, he trusted his own life and the lives of his brother and 2 sons to the event of a naval combat. The dominion of the sea was disputed in 3 engagements, in sight of the Isle of Corfu. In the 2 former, the skill and numbers of the allies were superior. but in the third the Normans obtained a final and complete victory. The light brigantines of the Greeks were scattered in ignominious flight. The nine castles of the Venetians maintained a more obstinate conflict. Seven were sunk, two were taken. 2,500 captives implored in vain the mercy of the victor, and the daughter of Alexius deplores the loss of 13,000 of his subjects or allies. The want of experience had been supplied by the genius of Giscard, and each evening, when he had sounded a retreat, he calmly explored the causes of his repulse, and invented new methods how to remedy his own defects and to baffle the advantages of the enemy. The winter season suspended his progress. With the return of spring, he again aspired to the conquest of Constantinople. But instead of traversing the hills of Epirus, he turned his arms against Greece and the islands, where the spoils would repay the labor and where the land and sea forces might pursue their joint operations with vigor and effect. But in the Isle of Cephalonia, his projects were fatally blasted by an epidemical disease. Robert himself, in the 70th year of his age, expired in his tent, and a suspicion of poison was imputed by public rumor to his wife, or to the Greek emperor. This premature death might allow a boundless scope for the imagination of his future exploits, and the event sufficiently declares that the Norman greatness was founded on his life. Without the appearance of an enemy, a victorious army dispersed or retreated in disorder and consternation. And Alexius, who had trembled for his empire, rejoiced in his deliverance. The galley which transported the remains of Giscard was shipwrecked on the Italian shore. But the duke's body was recovered from the sea and deposited in the sepulchre of Venusia, a place more illustrious for the birth of Horace than for the burial of the Norman heroes. Roger, his second son and successor, immediately sunk to the humble station of a Duke of Apulia. The esteem or partiality of his father left the valiant Bohemond to the inheritance of his sword. The national tranquillity was disturbed by his claims, till the first crusade against the infidels of the East opened a more splendid field of glory and conquest. Of human life, the most glorious or humble prospects are alike and soon bounded by the sepulchre. The male line of Robert Giscard was extinguished, both in Apulia and at Antioch, in the second generation. But his younger brother became the father of a line of kings, and the son of the great count was endowed with the name, the conquests, and the spirit of the first Roger. The heir of that Norman adventurer was born in Sicily, and at the age of only 4 years he succeeded to the sovereignty of the island, a lot which reason might envy, could she indulge for a moment the visionary, though virtuous, wish of dominion. Had Roger been content with his fruitful patrimony, a happy and grateful people might have blessed their benefactor, and if a wise administration could have restored the prosperous times of the Greek colonies, the opulence and power of Sicily alone might have equaled the widest scope that could be acquired and desolated by the sword of war. But the ambition of the great count was ignorant of these noble pursuits. It was gratified by the vulgar means of violence and artifice. He sought to obtain the undivided possession of Palermo, of which one moiety had been ceded to the elder branch, struggled to enlarge his Calabrian limits beyond the measure of former treaties, and impatiently watched the declining health of his cousin William of Apulia, the grandson of Robert. On the first intelligence of his premature death, Roger sailed from Palermo with 7 galleys, cast anchor in the Bay of Salerno, received, after 10 days' negotiation, an oath of fidelity from the Norman capital, commanded the submission of the barons, and extorted a legal investiture from the reluctant popes, who could not long endure either the friendship or enmity of a powerful vassal. The sacred spot of Benevento was respectfully spared, as the patrimony of St. Peter. but the reduction of Capua and Naples completed the design of his uncle Giscard, and the sole inheritance of the Norman conquests was possessed by the victorious Roger. A conscious superiority of power and merit prompted him to disdain the titles of Duke and of Count, and the Isle of Sicily, with a third, perhaps, of the continent of Italy, might form the basis of a kingdom which would only yield to the monarchies of France and England. The chiefs of the nation who attended his coronation at Palermo might doubtless pronounce under what name he should reign over them. But the example of a Greek tyrant or a Saracen emir was insufficient to justify his regal character, and the nine kings of the Latin world might disclaim their new associate unless he were consecrated by the authority of the supreme pontiff. The pride of Anacletus was pleased to confer a title which the pride of the Norman had stooped to solicit, but his own legitimacy was attacked by the adverse election of Innocent II, and while Anacletus sat in the Vatican, the successful fugitive was acknowledged by the nations of Europe. The infant monarchy of Roger was shaken and almost overthrown by the unlucky choice of an ecclesiastical patron, and the sword of Lothair II of Germany, the excommunications of Innocent, the fleets of Pisa, and the zeal of St. Bernard were united for the ruin of the Sicilian robber. After a gallant resistance, the Norman prince was driven from the continent of Italy. The new Duke of Apulia was invested by the Pope and the Emperor, each of whom held one end of the gonfanon, or flagstaff, as a token that they asserted their right and suspended their quarrel. But such jealous friendship was of short and precarious duration. The German army soon vanished in disease and desertion. The Apulian Duke, with all his adherents, was exterminated by a conqueror who seldom forgave either the dead or the living. Like his predecessor Leo IX, the feeble, though haughty pontiff became the captive and friend of the Normans, and their reconciliation was celebrated by the eloquence of Bernard, who now revered the title and virtues of the King of Sicily. As a penance for his impious war against the successor of St. Peter, that monarch might have promised to display the banner of the cross, and he accomplished with ardor a vow so propitious to his interest and revenge. The recent injuries of Sicily might provoke a just retaliation on the heads of the Saracens. The Normans, whose blood had been mingled with so many subject streams, were encouraged to remember and emulate the naval trophies of their fathers, and in the maturity of their strength they contended with the decline of an African power. When the Fatimite caliph departed for the conquest of Egypt, he rewarded the real merit and apparent fidelity of his servant Joseph with a gift of his royal mantle and 40 Arabian horses, his palace with its sumptuous furniture, and the government of the kingdoms of Tunis and Algiers. The Zairides, the descendants of Joseph, forgot their allegiance and gratitude to a distant benefactor, grasped and abused the fruits of prosperity, and after running the little course of an Oriental dynasty, were now fainting in their own weakness. On the side of the land they were pressed by the Almohades, the fanatical princes of Morocco, while the seacoast was open to the enterprises of the Greeks and Franks, who, before the close of the 11th century, had extorted a ransom of 200,000 pieces of gold. By the first arms of Roger, the island or rock of Malta, which has been since ennobled by a military and religious colony, was inseparably annexed to the crown of Sicily. Tripoli, a strong and maritime city, was the next object of his attack, and the slaughter of the males, the captivity of the females, might be justified by the frequent practice of the Muslims themselves. The capital of the Zairides was named Africa from the country, and Mahadia from the Arabian founder. It is strongly built on a neck of land, but the imperfection of the harbour is not compensated by the fertility of the adjacent plain. Mahardia was besieged by George the Sicilian Admiral with a fleet of 150 galleys, amply provided with men and the instruments of mischief. The sovereign had fled. The Moorish governor refused to capitulate, declined the last and irresistible assault, and, secretly escaping with the Muslim inhabitants, abandoned the place and its treasures to the rapacious Franks. In successive expeditions, the king of Sicily or his lieutenants reduced the cities of Tunis, Safax, Capsia, Bona, and a long tract of the seacoast. The fortresses were garrisoned. The country was tributary, and a boast that it held Africa in subjection might be inscribed with some flattery on the sword of Roger. After his death, that sword was broken, and these transmarine possessions were neglected, evacuated, or lost under the troubled reign of his successor. The triumphs of Scipio and Belisarius have proved that the African continent is neither inaccessible nor invincible. Yet the great princes and powers of Christendom have repeatedly failed in their armaments against the Moors, who may still glory in the easy conquest and long servitude of Spain. Since the decease of Robert Giscard, the Normans had relinquished, above 60 years, their hostile designs against the Empire of the East. The policy of Roger solicited a public and private union with the Greek princes, whose alliance would dignify his regal character. He demanded in marriage a daughter of the Comnenian family, and the first steps of the treaty seemed to promise a favorable event. But the contemptuous treatment of his ambassadors exasperated the vanity of the new monarch, and the insolence of the Byzantine court was expiated, according to the laws of nations, by the sufferings of a guiltless people. With the fleet of 70 galleys, George, the admiral of Sicily, appeared before Corfu, and both the island and city were delivered into his hands by the disaffected inhabitants, who had yet to learn that a siege is still more calamitous than a tribute. In this invasion, of some moment in the annals of commerce, the Normans spread themselves by sea and over the provinces of Greece, and the venerable age of Athens, Thebes, and Corinth was violated by rapine and cruelty. Of the wrongs of Athens no memorial remains. The ancient walls, which encompassed, without guarding, the opulence of Thebes, were scaled by the Latin Christians. But their sole use of the gospel was to sanctify an oath that the lawful owners had not secreted any relic of their inheritance or industry. On the approach of the Normans, the lower town of Corinth was evacuated. The Greeks retired to the citadel, which was seated on a lofty eminence, abundantly watered by the classic fountain of Pirene, an impregnable fortress if the want of courage could be balanced by any advantages of art or nature. As soon as the besiegers had surmounted the labor, their sole labor, of climbing the hill, their general, from the commanding eminence, admired his own victory and testified his gratitude to heaven by tearing from the altar the precious image of Theodore, the tutelary saint. The silk weavers of both sexes, whom George transported to Sicily, composed the most valuable part of the spoil. And in comparing the skillful industry of the mechanic with the sloth and cowardice of the soldier, he was heard to exclaim that the distaff and loom were the only weapons which the Greeks were capable of using. The progress of this naval armament was marked by two conspicuous events, the rescue of the King of France and the insult of the Byzantine capital. In his return by sea from an unfortunate crusade, Louis VII was intercepted by the Greeks, who basely violated the laws of honor and religion. The fortunate encounter of the Norman fleet delivered the royal captive, and after a free and honorable entertainment in the court of Sicily, Louis continued his journey to Rome and Paris. In the absence of the emperor, Constantinople and the Hellespont were left without defense and without the suspicion of danger. The clergy and people, for the soldiers had followed the standard of Manuel, were astonished and dismayed at the hostile appearance of a line of galleys which boldly cast anchor in the front of the imperial city. The forces of the Sicilian admiral were inadequate to the siege or assault of an immense and populous metropolis. But George enjoyed the glory of humbling the Greek arrogance and of marking the path of conquest to the navies of the West. He landed some soldiers to rifle the fruits of the royal gardens and pointed with silver, or most probably with fire, the arrows which he discharged against the palace of the Caesars. This playful outrage of the pirates of Sicily, who had surprised an unguarded moment, Manuel affected to despise, while his martial spirit and the forces of the empire were awakened to revenge. The archipelago and Ionian Sea were covered with his squadrons and those of Venice. But I know not by what favorable allowance of transports, victualers, and pinnaces our reason, or even our fancy, can be reconciled to the stupendous account of 1,500 vessels, which is proposed by a Byzantine historian. These operations were directed with prudence and energy. In his homeward voyage, George lost 19 of his galleys, which were separated and taken. After an obstinate defense, Corfu implored the clemency of her lawful sovereign, nor could a ship, a soldier of the Norman prince, be found, unless as a captive, within the limits of the Eastern Empire. The prosperity and the health of Roger were already in a declining state. While he listened in his palace of Palermo to the messengers of victory or defeat, the invincible Manuel, the foremost in every assault, was celebrated by the Greeks and Latins as the Alexander, or the Hercules of the age. A prince of such a temper could not be satisfied with having repelled the insolence of a barbarian. It was the right and duty, it might be the interest and glory of Manuel to restore the ancient majesty of the empire, to recover the provinces of Italy and Sicily, and to chastise this pretended king, the grandson of a Norman vassal. The natives of Calabria were still attached to the Greek language and worship, which had been inexorably prescribed by the Latin clergy. After the loss of her dukes, Apulia was chained as a servile appendage to the crown of Sicily. The founder of the monarchy had ruled by the sword, and his death had abated the fear without healing the discontent of his subjects. The feudal government was always pregnant with the seeds of rebellion, and a nephew of Roger himself invited the enemies of his family and nation. The majesty of the purple and a series of Hungarian and Turkish wars prevented Manuel from embarking his person in the Italian expedition. To the brave and noble Palaeologus, his lieutenant, the Greek monarch entrusted a fleet and army. The siege of Bari was his first exploit, and in every operation, gold as well as steel was the instrument of victory. Salerno and some places along the western coast maintained their fidelity to the Norman king, but he lost in two campaigns the greater part of his continental possessions, and the modest emperor, disdaining all flattery and falsehood, was content with the reduction of 300 cities or villages of Apulia and Calabria, whose names and titles were inscribed on all the walls of the palace. The prejudices of the Latins were gratified by a genuine or fictitious donation under the seal of the German Caesars. But the successor of Constantine soon renounced this ignominious pretense, claimed the indefeasible dominion of Italy, then professed his design of chasing the barbarians beyond the Alps. By the artful speeches, liberal gifts, and unbounded promises of their eastern ally, the free cities were encouraged to persevere in their generous struggle against the despotism of Frederick Barbarossa. The walls of Milan were rebuilt by the contributions of Manuel, and he poured, says the historian, a river of gold into the bosom of Ancona, whose attachment to the Greeks was fortified by the jealous enmity of the Venetians. The situation and trade of Ancona rendered it an important garrison in the heart of Italy. It was twice besieged by the arms of Frederick. The imperial forces were twice repulsed by the spirit of freedom. That spirit was animated by the ambassador of Constantinople, and the most intrepid patriots, the most faithful servants, were rewarded by the wealth and honors of the Byzantine court. The pride of Manuel disdained and rejected a barbarian colleague. His ambition was excited by the hope of stripping the purple from the German usurpers and of establishing in the West, as in the East, his lawful title of sole emperor of the Romans. With this view, he solicited the alliance of the people and the Bishop of Rome. Several of the nobles embraced the cause of the Greek monarch. The splendid nuptials of his niece with Odo Frangipani secured the support of that powerful family, and his royal standard or image was entertained with due reverence in the ancient metropolis. During the quarrel between Frederick and Alexander III, the Pope twice received in the Vatican the ambassadors of Constantinople. They flattered his piety by the long-promised union of the two churches, tempted the avarice of his venal court, and exhorted the Roman pontiff to seize the just provocation, the favorable moment, to humble the savage insolence of the Alemanni, and to acknowledge the true representative of Constantine and Augustus. But these Italian conquests, this universal reign, soon escaped from the hand of the Greek emperor. His first demands were eluded by the prudence of Alexander III, who paused on this deep and momentous revolution. Nor could the Pope be seduced by personal dispute to renounce the perpetual inheritance of the Latin name. After the reunion with Frederick, he spoke a more peremptory language, confirmed the acts of his predecessors, excommunicated the adherents of Manuel, then pronounced the first separation of the churches, or at least the empires of Constantinople and Rome. The free cities of Lombardy no longer remembered their foreign benefactor, and without preserving the friendship of Ancona, he soon incurred the enmity of Venice. By his own avarice or the complaints of his subjects, the Greek emperor was provoked to arrest the persons and confiscate the effects of the Venetian merchants. This violation of the public faith exasperated a free and commercial people. 100 galleys were launched and armed in as many days. They swept the coasts of Dalmatia and Greece. But after some mutual wounds, the war was terminated by an agreement inglorious to the empire, insufficient for the republic, and a complete vengeance of these and of fresh injuries was reserved for the succeeding generation. The lieutenant of Manuel had informed his sovereign that he was strong enough to quell any domestic revolt of Apulia and Calabria, but that his forces were inadequate to resist the impending attack of the king of Sicily. His prophecy was soon verified. The death of Palaeologus devolved the command on several chiefs, alike eminent in rank, alike defective in military talents. The Greeks were oppressed by land and sea, and a captive remnant that escaped the swords of the Normans and Saracens abjured all future hostility against the person or dominions of their conqueror. Yet the king of Sicily esteemed the courage and constancy of Manuel, who had landed a second army on the Italian shore. He respectfully addressed the new Justinian, solicited a peace or truce of 30 years, accepted as a gift the regal title, and acknowledged himself the military vassal of the Roman Empire. The Byzantine Caesars acquiesced in this shadow of dominion, without expecting, perhaps without desiring, the service of a Norman army, and the truce of 30 years was not disturbed by any hostilities between Sicily and Constantinople. About the end of that period, the throne of Manuel was usurped by an inhuman tyrant who had deserved the abhorrence of his country and mankind. The sword of William II, the grandson of Roger, was drawn by a fugitive of the Comnenian race, and the subjects of Andronicus might salute the strangers as friends, since they detested their sovereign as the worst of enemies. The Latin historians expatiate on the rapid progress of the 4 counts who invaded Romania with a fleet and army, and reduced many castles and cities to the obedience of the king of Sicily. The Greeks accuse and magnify the wanton and sacrilegious cruelties that were perpetrated in the sack of Thessalonica, the second city of the empire. The former deplore the fate of those invincible but unsuspecting warriors who were destroyed by the arts of a vanquished foe. The latter applaud, in songs of triumph, the repeated victories of their countrymen on the Sea of Marmora, or Propontis, on the banks of the Strymon, and under the walls of Durazzo. A revolution which punished the crimes of Andronicus had united against the Franks the zeal and courage of the successful insurgents. 10,000 were slain in battle, and Isaac Angelus, the new emperor, might indulge his vanity or vengeance in the treatment of 4,000 captives. Such was the event of the last contest between the Greeks and Normans. Before the expiration of 20 years, the rival nations were lost or degraded in foreign servitude, and the successors of Constantine did not long survive to insult the fall of the Sicilian monarchy. The scepter of Roger successively devolved to his son and grandson. They might be confounded under the name of William. They are strongly discriminated by the epithets of the bad and the good. But these epithets, which appear to describe the perfection of vice and virtue, cannot strictly be applied to either of the Norman princes. When he was roused to arms by danger and shame, the first William did not degenerate from the valor of his race, but his temper was slothful, his manners were dissolute, his passions headstrong and mischievous, and the monarch is responsible not only for his personal vices, but for those of Majo, the great admiral, who abused the confidence and conspired against the life of his benefactor. From the Arabian conquest, Sicily had imbibed a deep tincture of Oriental manners, the despotism, the pomp, and even the harem of a sultan, and a Christian people was oppressed and insulted by the ascendant of the eunuchs who openly professed or secretly cherished the religion of Muhammad. An eloquent historian of the times has delineated the misfortunes of his country. The ambition and fall of the ungrateful Majo, the revolt and punishment of his assassins, the imprisonment and deliverance of the king himself, the private feuds that arose from the public confusion, and the various forms of calamity and discord which afflicted Palermo, the island, and the continent during the reign of William I and the minority of his son. The youth, innocence, and beauty of William II endeared him to the nation. The factions were reconciled, the laws were revived, and from the manhood to the premature death of that amiable prince, Sicily enjoyed a short season of peace, justice, and happiness, whose value was enhanced by the remembrance of the past and the dread of futurity. The illegitimate male posterity of Tancred of Hauteville was extinct in the person of the second William, but his aunt, the daughter of Roger, had married the most powerful prince of the age, and Henry VI, the son of Frederick Barbarossa, descended from the Alps to claim the imperial crown and the inheritance of his wife. Against the unanimous wish of a free people, this inheritance could only be acquired by arms, and I am pleased to transcribe the style and sense of the historian Falcandus, who writes at the moment and on the spot with the feelings of a patriot and the prophetic eye of a statesman. Constantia, the daughter of Sicily, nursed from her cradle in the pleasures and plenty, and educated in the arts and manners of this fortunate isle, departed long since to enrich the barbarians with our treasures, and now returns with her savage allies to contaminate the beauties of her venerable parent. Already I behold the swarms of angry barbarians, our opulent cities, the places flourishing in a long peace, are shaken with fear, desolated by slaughter, consumed by rapine, and polluted by intemperance and lust. I see the massacre or captivity of our citizens, the rapes of our virgins and matrons. In this extremity, he interrogates a friend, how must the Sicilians act? By the unanimous election of a king of valour and experience, Sicily and Calabria might yet be preserved. For in the levity of the Apulians, ever eager for new revolutions, I can repose neither confidence nor hope. Should Calabria be lost, the lofty towers, the numerous youth, and the naval strength of Messina might guard the passage against a foreign invader. If the savage Germans coalesce with the pirates of Messina, if they destroy with fire the fruitful region so often wasted by the fires of Mount Etna, what resource will be left for the interior parts of the island, these noble cities which should never be violated by the hostile footsteps of a barbarian? Catana has again been overwhelmed by an earthquake. The ancient virtue of Syracuse expires in poverty and solitude. But Palermo is still crowned with a diadem, and her triple walls enclose the active multitudes of Christians and Saracens. If the two nations under one king can unite for their common safety, they may rush on the barbarians with invincible arms. But if the Saracens, fatigued by a repetition of injuries, should now retire and rebel, if they should occupy the castles of the mountains and seacoast, the unfortunate Christians, exposed to a double attack, and placed, as it were, between the hammer and the anvil, must resign themselves to hopeless and inevitable servitude. We must not forget that a priest here prefers his country to his religion, and that the Muslims, whose alliance he seeks, were still numerous and powerful in the state of Sicily. The hopes, or at least the wishes, of Falcundus were at first gratified by the free and unanimous election of Tancred, the grandson of the first king, whose birth was illegitimate, but whose civil and military virtues shone without a blemish. During 4 years, the term of his life and reign, he stood in arms on the farthest verge of the Apulian frontier against the powers of Germany, and the restitution of a royal captive, of Constantia herself, without injury or ransom, may appear to surpass the most liberal measure of policy or reason. After his decease, the kingdom of his widow and infant son fell without a struggle, and Henry pursued his victorious march from Capua to Palermo. The political balance of Italy was destroyed by his success, and if the Pope and the free cities had consulted their obvious and real interest, they would have combined the powers of earth and heaven to prevent the dangerous union of the German Empire with the Kingdom of Sicily. But the subtle policy for which the Vatican has so often been praised or arraigned was on this occasion blind and inactive. And if it were true that Celestine III had kicked away the imperial crown from the head of the prostrate Henry, such an act of impotent pride could serve only to cancel an obligation and provoke an enemy. The Genoese, who enjoyed a beneficial trade and establishment in Sicily, listened to the promise of his boundless gratitude and speedy departure. Their fleet commanded the Straits of Messina, and opened the harbour of Palermo. And the first act of his government was to abolish the privileges and to seize the property of these imprudent allies. The last hope of Falcundus was defeated by the discord of the Christians and Mohammedans. They fought in the capital. Several thousands of the latter were slain, but their surviving brethren fortified the mountains and disturbed above 30 years the peace of the island. By the policy of Frederick II, 60,000 Saracens were transplanted to Nocera in Apulia. In their wars against the Roman Church, the emperor and his son Mainfroi were strengthened and disgraced by the service of the enemies of Christ, and this national colony maintained their religion and manners in the heart of Italy, till they were extirpated at the end of the 13th century by the zeal and revenge of the House of Anjou. All the calamities which the prophetic orator had deplored were surpassed by the cruelty and avarice of the German conqueror. He violated the royal sepulchres, and explored the secret treasures of the palace, Palermo, and the whole kingdom. The pearls and jewels, however precious, might be easily removed, but 160 horses were laden with the gold and silver of Sicily. The young king, his mother and sisters, and the nobles of both sexes were separately confined in the fortresses of the Alps, and on the slightest rumour of rebellion the captives were deprived of life, of their eyes, or of the hope of posterity. Constantia herself was touched with sympathy for the miseries of her country, and the heiress of the Norman line might struggle to check her despotic husband and to save the patrimony of her newborn son, of an emperor so famous in the next age under the name of Frederick II. 10 years after this revolution, the French monarchs annexed to their crown the Duchy of Normandy. The scepter of her ancient dukes had been transmitted by a granddaughter of William the Conqueror to the House of Plantagenet. And the adventurous Normans, who had raised so many trophies in France, England, and Ireland, in Apulia, Sicily, and the East, were lost, either in victory or servitude, among the vanquished nations. Chapter 57. The Turks of the House of Seljuk. Their revolt against Mahmud, conqueror of Hindustan. Tughrul subdues Persia and protects the caliphs. Defeat and captivity of the Emperor Romanus Diogenes by Alp Arslan. Power and magnificence of Malek Shah. Conquest of Asia Minor and Syria. State and oppression of Jerusalem. Pilgrimages to the Holy Sepulchre. From the Isle of Sicily, the reader must transport himself beyond the Caspian Sea to the original seat of the Turks, or Turkmans, against whom the First Crusade was principally directed. Their Scythian Empire of the 6th century was long since dissolved, but the name was still famous among the Greeks and Orientals, and the fragments of the nation, each a powerful and independent people, were scattered over the desert from China to the Oxus and the Danube. The colony of Hungarians was admitted into the Republic of Europe, and the thrones of Asia were occupied by slaves and soldiers of Turkish extraction. While Apulia and Sicily were subdued by the Norman lance, a swarm of these northern shepherds overspread the kingdoms of Persia. Their princes of the race of Seljuk erected a splendid and solid empire from Samarkand to the confines of Greece and Egypt, and the Turks have maintained their dominion in Asia Minor till the victorious crescent has been planted on the dome of Santa Sophia. One of the greatest of the Turkish princes was Mahmud, or Mahmud, the Ghaznavide, who reigned in the eastern provinces of Persia, 1,000 years after the birth of Christ. His father, Sebektagi, was the slave of the slave of the slave of the commander of the faithful. But in this descent of servitude, the first degree was merely titular, since it was filled by the sovereign of Transoxiana and Khorasan, who still paid a nominal allegiance to the caliph of Baghdad. The second rank was that of a minister of state, a lieutenant of the Samanides, who broke by his revolt the bonds of political slavery. But the third step was a state of real and domestic servitude in the family of that rebel, from which Sebektagi, by his courage and dexterity, ascended to the supreme command of the city and provinces of Ghazna, as the son-in-law and successor of his grateful master. The falling dynasty of the Samanides was at first protected and at last overthrown by their servants, and in the public disorders the fortune of Mahmud continually increased. From him the title of Sultan was first invented, and his kingdom was enlarged from Transoxiana to the neighbourhood of Isfahan, from the shores of the Caspian to the mouth of the Indus. But the principal source of his fame and riches was the holy war which he waged against the Gentoos of Hindustan. In this foreign narrative I may not consume a page, and a volume would scarcely suffice to recapitulate the battles and sieges of his 12 expeditions. Never was the Muslim hero dismayed by the inclemency of the seasons, the height of the mountains, the breadth of the rivers, the barrenness of the desert, the multitudes of the enemy, or the formidable array of their elephants of war. The Sultan of Ghazna surpassed the limits of the conquests of Alexander. After a march of 3 months over the hills of Kashmir and Tibet, he reached the famous city of Kinogi, on the Upper Ganges, and in a naval combat on one of the branches of the Indus, he fought and vanquished 4,000 boats of the natives. Delhi, Lahore, and Multan were compelled to open their gates. The fertile kingdom of Gujarat attracted his ambition and tempted his stay, and his avarice indulged the fruitless project of discovering the golden and aromatic isles of the Southern Ocean. On the payment of a tribute, the Rajas preserved their dominions, the people, their lives, and fortunes. But to the religion of Hindustan, the zealous Muslim was cruel and inexorable. Many hundred temples or pagodas were levelled with the ground. Many thousand idols were demolished, and the servants of the Prophet were stimulated and rewarded by the precious materials of which they were composed. The pagoda of Somnath was situated on the promontory of Gujarat, in the neighbourhood of Diu, one of the last remaining possessions of the Portuguese. It was endowed with the revenue of 2,000 villages. 2,000 Brahmins were consecrated to the service of the deity, whom they washed each morning and evening in water from the distant Ganges. The subordinate ministers consisted of 300 musicians, 300 barbers, and 500 dancing girls, conspicuous for their birth or beauty. Three sides of the temple were protected by the ocean. The narrow isthmus was fortified by a natural or artificial precipice, and the city and adjacent country were peopled by a nation of fanatics. They confessed the sins and the punishment of Kinogi and Delhi, but if the impious stranger should presume to approach their holy precincts, he would surely be overwhelmed by a blast of the divine vengeance. By this challenge, the faith of Mahmud was animated to a personal trial of the strength of this Indian deity. 50,000 of his worshippers were pierced by the spear of the Muslims. The walls were scaled, the sanctuary was profaned, and the conqueror aimed a blow of his iron mace at the head of the idol. The trembling Brahmins are said to have offered 10 million sterling for his ransom, and it was urged by the wisest counsellors that the destruction of a stone image would not change the hearts of the Gentoos, and that such a sum might be dedicated to the relief of the true believers. "Your reasons," replied the Sultan, "are specious and strong, but never in the eyes of posterity shall Mahmud appear as a merchant of idols." He repeated his blows, and a treasure of pearls and rubies, concealed in the belly of the statue, explained in some degree the devout prodigality of the Brahmins. The fragments of the idol were distributed to Ghazna, Mecca, and Medina. Baghdad listened to the edifying tale, and Mahmud was saluted by the caliph with the title of guardian of the fortune and faith of Muhammad. From the paths of blood, and such is the history of nations, I cannot refuse to turn aside to gather some flowers of science or virtue. The name of Mahmud the Ghaznavide is still venerable in the East. His subjects enjoyed the blessings of prosperity and peace. His vices were concealed by the veil of religion. Then two familiar examples will testify his justice and magnanimity. As he sat in the divan, an unhappy subject bowed before the throne to accuse the insolence of a Turkish soldier who had driven him from his house and bed. "Suspend your clamours," said Mahmud. inform me of his next visit, and ourself in person will judge and punish the offender." The Sultan followed his guide, invested the house with his guards, and, extinguishing the torches, pronounced the death of the criminal who had been seized in the act of rapine and adultery. After the execution of his sentence, the lights were rekindled. Mahmud fell prostrate in prayer, and rising from the ground demanded some homely fare, which he devoured with the voraciousness of hunger. The poor man, whose injury he had avenged, was unable to suppress his astonishment and curiosity, and the courteous monarch condescended to explain the motives of this singular behaviour. "I had reason to suspect that none except one of my sons could dare to perpetrate such an outrage, and I extinguished the lights that my justice might be blind and inexorable. My prayer was a thanksgiving on the discovery of the offender, and so painful was my anxiety that I had passed 3 days without food since the first moment of your complaint." The Sultan of Ghazna had declared war against the dynasty of the Buwidis, the sovereigns of the western Persia. He was disarmed by an epistle of the Sultana mother and delayed his invasion till the manhood of her son. "During the life of my husband," said the artful regent, "I was ever apprehensive of your ambition. He was a prince and a soldier worthy of your arms. He is now no more. His scepter has passed to a woman and a child, and you dare not attack their infancy and weakness. How inglorious would be your conquest, how shameful your defeat, and yet the event of war is in the hand of the Almighty." Avarice was the only defect that tarnished the illustrious character of Mahmud, and never has that passion been more richly satiated. The Orientals exceed the measure of credibility in the account of millions of gold and silver, such as the avidity of man has never accumulated. In the magnitude of pearls, diamonds, and rubies, such as have never been produced by the workmanship of nature. Yet the soil of Hindustan is impregnated with precious minerals. Her trade, in every age, has attracted the gold and silver of the world, and her virgin spoils were rifled by the first of the Mohammedan conquerors. His behavior in the last days of his life evinces the vanity of these possessions, so laboriously won, so dangerously held, and so inevitably lost. He surveyed the vast and various chambers of the treasury of Ghazna, burst into tears, and again closed the doors, without bestowing any portion of the wealth which he could no longer hope to preserve. The following day he reviewed the state of his military force. 100,000 foot, 55,000 horse, and 1,300 elephants of battle. He again wept the instability of human greatness, and his grief was embittered by the hostile progress of the Turkmans, whom he had introduced into the heart of his Persian kingdom. In the modern depopulation of Asia, the regular operation of government and agriculture is confined to the neighborhood of cities, and the distant country is abandoned to the pastoral tribes of Arabs, Kurds, and Turkmans. Of the last-mentioned people, two considerable branches extend on either side of the Caspian Sea. The western colony can muster 40,000 soldiers. The eastern, less obvious to the traveller, but more strong and populous, has increased to the number of 100,000 families. In the midst of civilized nations, they preserve the manners of the Scythian desert, remove their encampments with a change of seasons, and feed their cattle among the ruins of palaces and temples. Their flocks and herds are their only riches. Their tents, either black or white, according to the color of the banner, are covered with felt and of a circular form. Their winter apparel is a sheepskin, a robe of cloth or cotton, their summer garment. The features of the men are harsh and ferocious. The countenance of their women is soft and pleasing. Their wandering life maintains the spirit and exercise of arms. They fight on horseback, and their courage is displayed in frequent contests with each other and with their neighbors. For the license of pasture, they pay a slight tribute to the sovereign of the land. But the domestic jurisdiction is in the hands of the chiefs and elders. The first emigration of the Eastern Turkmans, the most ancient of the race, may be ascribed to the 10th century of the Christian era. In the decline of the caliphs and the weakness of their lieutenants, the barrier of the Yaksatis was often violated. In each invasion, after the victory or retreat of their countrymen, some wandering tribe embracing the Mohammedan faith obtained a free encampment in the spacious plains and pleasant climate of Transoxiana and Karizmi. The Turkish slaves who aspired to the throne encouraged these emigrations, which recruited their armies, awed their subjects and rivals, and protected the frontier against the wilder natives of Turkestan. And this policy was abused by Mahmud the Ghaznavide beyond the example of former times. He was admonished of his error by the chief of the race of Seljuk, who dwelt in the territory of Bukhara. The Sultan had inquired what supply of men he could furnish for military service. "If you send," replied Ismail, "one of these arrows into our camp, 50,000 of your servants will mount on horseback." "And if that number," continued Mahmud, "should not be sufficient, send this second arrow to the horde of Balik, and you will find 50,000 more." "But," said the Ghaznavidi, dissembling his anxiety, "if I should stand in need of the whole force of your kindred tribes?" "Dispatch my bow," was the last reply of Ismail, "and as it is circulated around, the summons will be obeyed by 200,000 horse." The apprehension of such formidable friendship induced Mahmud to transport the most obnoxious tribes into the heart of Khorasan, where they would be separated from their brethren of the river Oxus, and enclosed on all sides by the walls of obedient cities. But the face of the country was an object of temptation rather than terror, and the vigor of government was relaxed by the absence and death of the Sultan of Ghazna. The shepherds were converted into robbers. The bands of robbers were collected into an army of conquerors. As far as Isfahan and the Tigris, Persia was afflicted by their predatory inroads, and the Turkmans were not ashamed or afraid to measure their courage and numbers with the proudest sovereigns of Asia. Masud, the son and successor of Mahmud, had too long neglected the advice of his wisest umras. "Your enemies," they repeatedly urged, "were in their origin a swarm of ants. They are now little snakes, and unless they be instantly crushed, they will acquire the venom and magnitude of serpents." After some alternatives of truce and hostility, after the repulse or partial success of his lieutenants, the Sultan marched in person against the Turkmans, who attacked him on all sides with barbarous shouts and irregular onset. "Masud," says the Persian historian, "plunged singly to oppose the torrent of gleaming arms, exhibiting such acts of gigantic force and valor as never king had before displayed. A few of his friends, roused by his words and actions, and that innate honor which inspires the brave, seconded their lord so well that, wheresoever he turned his fatal sword, the enemies were mowed down or retreated before him. But now, when victory seemed to blow on his standard, misfortune was active behind it. For when he looked round, he beheld almost his whole army, excepting that body he commanded in person, devouring the paths of flight." The Ghaznavide was abandoned by the cowardice or treachery of some generals of Turkish race. And this memorable day of Zendikan founded in Persian the dynasty of the Shepherd Kings. The victorious Turkmans immediately proceeded to the election of a king, and if the probable tale of a Latin historian deserves any credit, they determined by lot the choice of their new master. A number of arrows were successively inscribed with the name of a tribe, a family, and a candidate. They were drawn from the bundle by the hand of a child, and the important prize was obtained by Togrul Beg, the son of Michael, the son of Seljuk, whose surname was immortalized in the greatness of his posterity. Sultan Mahmud, who valued himself on his skill in national genealogy, professed his ignorance of the family of Seljuk. Yet the father of that race appears to have been a chief of power and renown. For a daring intrusion into the harem of his prince, Seljuk was banished from Turkestan. With a numerous tribe of his friends and vassals, he passed the Juxartes, encamped in the neighborhood of Samarkand, embraced the religion of Muhammad, and acquired the crown of martyrdom in a war against the infidels. His age of 107 years surpassed the life of his son, and Seljuk adopted the care of his two grandsons, Tughrul and Ja'afar, the eldest of whom, at the age of 45, was invested with the title of Sultan in the royal city of Nishapur. The blind determination of chance was justified by the virtues of the successful candidate. It would be superfluous to praise the valor of a Turk, and the ambition of Tughrul was equal to his valor. By his arms, the Ghaznavides were expelled from the eastern kingdoms of Persia, and gradually driven to the banks of the Indus in search of a softer and more wealthy conquest. In the west he annihilated the dynasty of the Buyidis, and the scepter of Iraq passed from the Persian to the Turkish nation. The princes who had felt or who feared the Seljukian arrows bowed their heads in the dust. By the conquest of Azerbaijan, or Media, he approached the Roman confines, and the shepherd presumed to dispatch an ambassador, or herald, to demand the tribute and obedience of the Emperor of Constantinople. In his own dominions, Tughrul was the father of his soldiers and people. By firm and equal administration, Persia was relieved from the evils of anarchy, and the same hands which had been imbrued in blood became the guardians of justice and the public peace. The more rustic, perhaps the wisest, portion of the Turkmans continued to dwell in the tents of their ancestors, and from the Oxus to the Euphrates, these military colonies were protected and propagated by their native princes. But the Turks of the court and city were refined by business and softened by pleasure. They imitated the dress, language, and manners of Persia, and the royal palaces of Nishapur and Rei display the order and magnificence of a great monarchy. The most deserving of the Arabians and Persians were promoted to the honors of the state, and the whole body of the Turkish nation embraced with fervor and sincerity the religion of Muhammad. The northern swarms of barbarians who overspread both Europe and Asia have been irreconcilably separated by the consequences of a similar conduct. Among the Muslims, as among the Christians, their vague and local traditions have yielded to the reason and authority of the prevailing system, to the fame of antiquity and the consent of nations. But the triumph of the Quran is more pure and meritorious, as it was not assisted by any visible splendor of worship which might allure the pagans by some resemblance of idolatry. The first of the Seljukian sultans was conspicuous by his zeal and faith. Each day he repeated the 5 prayers which are enjoined to the true believers. Of each week, the 2 first days were consecrated by an extraordinary fast, and in every city a mosque was completed before Tughrul presumed to lay the foundations of a palace. With the belief of the Quran, the son of Seljuk imbibed a lively reverence for the successor of the prophet. But that sublime character was still disputed by the caliphs of Baghdad and Egypt, and each of the rivals was solicitous to prove his title in the judgment of the strong, though illiterate barbarians. Mahmud the Ghaznavidi had declared himself in favor of the line of Abbas, and had treated with indignity the robe of honor which was presented by the Fatimite ambassador. Yet the ungrateful Hashemite had changed with the change of fortune. He applauded the victory of Zendikun and named the Seljukian Sultan his temporal vice-regent over the Muslim world. As Tughrul executed and enlarged this important trust,